Amen. to you.
According to
husband.
Husband.
Asia.
Asia.
Yes, Christian.
Yes, Krishna.
Nisita.
Nisita.
Is my son.
Is my son.
Raja Ishvarasya.
Raja Ishvarasya.
Of my husband, Nanda
Maharaj. Of my husband, Nanda
Maharaj. Akila Vita Vita Pak.
Akila Vita Pak.
I am the possessor of unlimited opulence and wealth.
I am the possessor of unlimited opulence and wealth.
Sati.
Sati.
Because I am his wife.
Because I am his wife.
Gopya Cha.
Gopya Cha.
And all the damsels of the Kali Yuga.
And all the damsels
of the Kali Yuga. Gopa. All the Kali Yuga men are my subordinates.
All the Kali
Yuga
men are subordinates.
Saha Godana Cha.
With the cows and
calves.
Me.
Yat Maya.
Yat Maya.
All such things addressed by me are.
All such things addressed by me are.
After all.
After all.
Given by the mercy of the Supreme.
Given by the mercy of the Supreme.
Itam.
Thus.
Kumati. I am wrongly thinking they are my possessions.
I am wrongly thinking they are my possessions.
Samayati.
Samayati.
He is therefore my only shelter.
He is therefore my only shelter.
I am simply instrumental.
I am simply instrumental.
Translation of Srila Prabhupada. It is by the influence of the Supreme Lord's Maya that I am wrongly thinking that Nanda Maharaj is my husband, that Krishna is my son, and that because I am the queen of Nanda Maharaj, all the wealth of cows and calves are my possessions, and all the cowherd men and their wives are my subjects. Actually, I also am eternally subordinate to the Supreme Lord. He is my ultimate shelter. Purport. Following in the footsteps of Mother Jasoda, everyone should follow this mentality of renunciation. Whatever wealth, opulence, or whatever else we may possess belongs not to us, but to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the ultimate shelter of everyone and the ultimate owner of everything. As stated by the Lord Himself in Bhagavad Gita 5:29, Bhoktaram yadhi tapasam saranamoka yadhesharam suryam saranamutanam. The sages, knowing me as the ultimate purpose of all sacrifices and austerities, the Supreme Lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attain peace from the pangs of material miseries. We should not be proud of our possessions. As expressed by Mother Jasoda herein, quote, I am not the owner of possessions, the opulent wife of non-owner. The estate, the possessions, the cows and calves, and the subjects of the gopis and cowmen are all given to me. Unquote. When should give up thinking of my possessions, my son, and my husband? Janasya moyam aham namiti. Nothing belongs to anyone but the Supreme Lord. Only because of illusion do we wrongly think I am existing or everything belongs to me. Thus, Mother Jasoda completely surrendered unto the Supreme Lord. For the moment, she was rather disappointed, thinking, my endeavors to protect my son by charity and other auspicious activities are useless. The Supreme Lord has given me many things, but unless he takes charge of everything, there is no assurance of protection. I must therefore ultimately seek the shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As stated by Prahlada Maharaj, a father and mother cannot ultimately take care of their children. One's land, home, wealth, and all of one's possessions belong to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although we wrongly think, I am this, and these things are mine. Verse again. It is by the influence of the Supreme Lord's Maya that I am wrongly thinking that Nanda Maharaj is my husband, that Krishna is my son, and that because I am the queen of Nanda Maharaj, all the wealth of cows and calves so much to understand. When I was invited for recently, Bhakti Pushpam Maharaj, who's going to be visiting with Chef Takamaraj, gave a whole class just about Maya. And he said that he's writing a book about Maya. And there's just so much to understand, and I really don't presume to understand at all. But one thing that's clear in this verse is that Mother Yasoda was seeing a view of her life and her relationships in a different way than any other pastime. Because normally she was just thinking of Krishna as her son, and she has unlimited love for him, and she will do anything for him. So that's seeing through the veil of Yoga Maya. Yoga Maya, you can see Krishna. Yoga Maya partly covers the living entity. And so she was seeing Krishna, but she wasn't seeing him as the Supreme Lord. Because if she did, she wouldn't be able to act normally and naturally and have that motherly affection for him. She would have this awe and reverence, which blocks her ability to be his mother. So in this verse she's expressing that she's seeing Krishna as the Supreme Lord. She's seeing herself as it's just an unusual view. She's like stepping outside her normal way of being, and she's saying, "Oh, Krishna actually is God, and I'm actually the subject, and I'm wrongly identifying myself as Nanda Maharaj's wife, and therefore, you know, the subjects are, I'm thinking that they're my subjects, but they're actually not." So Srila Prabhupada, in his purport, he's giving us some very direct instructions. Starting with the first sentence, he's saying that everyone should follow Mother Yasoda's mentality of renunciation. And he's very clearly, Srila Prabhupada is very clearly pointing out that everything belongs to Krishna. Our body, mind, words, the physical things around us, just everything. He says that Krishna is the ultimate shelter of everyone and the ultimate owner of everything. So my experience of the early days in the movement was there was a great emphasis on renunciation. And in our, I would describe it as immature way, we did things that, looking back on it, I was thinking, we wouldn't do today. For instance, many young men in their early 20s even took the vows of sannyas. Well, we don't see 23-year-old men stepping forward and asking for sannyas. And yet, well, people describe the early days as Prabhupada had to kickstart the movement. Right? You've heard that phrase being used. And it's understandable. He needed strong leaders, and he made quite a few young men, gave them the sannyas order of life, gave them the strength to be those leaders that he needed. Unfortunately, as I said, I look back and say we were immature. Not everyone was able to maintain the vows. So therefore, there was, you know, obviously an element of pretension that we thought we could do something we couldn't do. But as the years have gone by and devotees have matured, now we see there's a more balanced, I would say there's a more balanced atmosphere. Because that emphasis on renunciation meant that, to some extent, women and children were not valued. And that meant that the whole Grihastha ashram wasn't valued. And I can say that my experience was, in listening to classes in the old days where this point of renunciation was emphasized a lot, and, you know, was considered in some temples a fall down to get married. So coming from the point of view of being a woman's body, I would hear these classes and understand that the men needed to be strong, and in order to do that, these classes, you know, emphasizing, you know, that they should maintain their brahmacharya vows, for instance. I mean, there was, the temples were mostly brahmacharis and brahmacharinis, and Grihastha ashram just wasn't, hadn't manifest itself very often. So it was understandable, but at the same time, the balance has to be there. It just has to be there. And I never experienced that Srila Prabhupada himself made any woman feel second class or tenth class or whatever. And he certainly had relationships with children that were very loving and so on. I did have an experience with wanting to renounce. There was, and it does have to do with Srila Prabhupada, because I wanted his permission to be renounced. There was a fad in 1976, around 1976, when the devotees discovered that in Vedic culture, women who are widows, when their husband dies, they're supposed to shave their head and wear white. First we heard about the wearing white part. And since we understood that the women who had been married to sannyasis, we were already calling them widows. So the devotees somehow heard about this, and some of the ladies who had been married to sannyasis, they put on white. And so this news spread around the movement pretty fast, and it occurred to the ladies as like women taking sannyas, or at least equal to that. So it was like a status. At least that's how I saw it. And so when I heard about it, I was thinking I was old. I was all of 29. And there was a saying in Islam that marriage after 30 isn't pleasing because you're set in your ways. Now, I'm not saying this came from Prabhupada. A lot of things that cropped up in the early days didn't necessarily come from Prabhupada, but somehow, you know, we attributed, you know, one of those prophets said. And so anyway, I was thinking it was appropriate for me to put on weight and be a widow. So, but I wanted Prabhupada's permission. And I was living in Mayapur at the time, and Prabhupada was fairly readily available because every evening he had an open darshan at 5 o'clock in his rooms. Anybody could go. But the thing is, I was not willing to ask this question in front of a group of people. And I was Kishima's servant, so I was able to go with her. I brought her to Papa's room. She actually needed help going down the stairs. And, it was a great excuse to go every night to Papa's darshans. So somehow, one day, Pishima wanted to go up early, and so we were in Prabhupada's quarters, and it was just Pishima, myself, and Srila Prabhupada, and I thought, hey, here's my opportunity. Now, again, so when you look back on things that happened, you're just like, oh, why did I do that? Because I've heard other devotees say that they had a chance to ask Prabhupada a question, and they asked something intelligent or something meaningful. You know, like, how can I serve you? That's the question Prabhupada asked his guru, or you know, how to be sincere, just, you know, some appropriate, meaningful question. But the question that I was waiting to ask Prabhupada was permission to wear white. And so, somehow, this is definitely one of the more embarrassing questions that I asked Prabhupada, but I said something came out of my mouth, I don't know what. And immediately Prabhupada said, why do you doubt? And I don't even know what I said. I mean, it was so unconscious that I didn't know the answer. I was like, but immediately I was like defensive, like, I don't doubt anything. And then I asked my question, can I wear white? And I don't think he really understood why I would be choosing to be a widow. You know, it was just, it didn't even make sense, but anyway, his answer was, ask for GBC. So I could understand that it was an inappropriate question. to ask the group, but you can see that just from my example, there was, and there was many others, and I ultimately did put on white, by the way, and shaved my head when I heard that everybody else was shaving their head, and, you know, and these fads just came around and jumped on their mind. But the mood was not, it wasn't coming from a practical or even a, it came from pretension. I could say noticed, or we were all wanting to be noticed as Srila Prabhupada, but I can't really explain except that it was not coming from a place of reality or sincerity, really. Because obviously, I'm married now, I've been married for 35 years, so, you know, to be a widow wasn't real. But this is our attempts to be renounced. It wasn't, I think we have more of an understanding now. When we gave a couple of days ago, we heard a class by Vyasa Suno about honoring the mother and father. So in the early days, that was our experience of family, was our parents. And we found it easy to turn our backs on them, because when we became devotees, most parents, the vast majority of parents, couldn't understand why we gave up material life and became devotees. But we didn't have the experience of the attachment of spouse and children. I mean, very few devotees in the early days were parents. So now that I've the experience of being a mother, I can understand that the depth of family attachment is not really easy to give up. And yet, Srila Prabhupada is emphasizing in this purport that we put Krishna in the middle, really. He's saying, again, that Krishna is the ultimate shelter of everyone, the ultimate owner of everything. So, since this is a Vrindavan community, most of us have a place of residence that's our own, we have possessions, we have, most of us have offspring. So, this is a lesson for us, you know, to put Krishna in the center and understand that he is the owner of everything and he's our only shelter. So another point, another direct instruction that Prabhupada is giving, he says, we should not be proud of our possessions. So I just love these statements of Srila Prabhupada when he's just like giving us direct instructions. And, you know, some other, just sort of her example here is, you know, she's seeing things in a different light in her life. And Prabhupada is saying, you know, we ultimately have to have that distance, renounced vision. Because it is a illusion to think that everything we own actually belongs to us. And another point that Srila Prabhupada is making clearly is, he said, to seek the shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because no one else can save you. And there's one sentence in the purport that I wasn't clear on what Prabhupada meant. I mean, he says, a father and mother cannot ultimately take care of their children. And since Prabhupada twice quoted this phrase, Janasri Boho Yam Ahama Meti, twice he quoted that in the purport. So that the verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the translation is, the attraction between male and female is the basic principle of material existence. On the basis of this misconception, which ties together the hearts of the male and female, one becomes attracted to his body, home, property, children, relatives, and wealth. In this way, one increases life's illusions and thinks in terms of I and mine. And in that purport, Srila Prabhupada is saying that the attachment to the family is the strongest illusion. And Also in a class that Srila Prabhupada gave in London in 1973, Prabhupada explains this a little more, where he says that every father and mother wants to protect the children, but still the child has to meet some danger and dies. There are so many experiences. Similarly, the father and mother is the counteraction for the dangers of the child, but Prahlada Maharaj is saying no, they are not counteraction. It is not that if the child is in danger, because the father and mother is very strong, very rich, he will be able to give protection to the child. No, that is not possible. So he's saying that Krishna really is our only shelter. There just isn't any other shelter. And he's inviting us to take full shelter of Krishna. By your permission, I would like to complete this part of the class. And because I haven't been in class here in about 7 months, I just wanted to share with you some of the experiences I had in those 7 months. One of the things I did was to do my annual Christmas mall, and there's nothing particularly exciting about that except that I met a wonderful devotee who lives in Wilmington, North Carolina, where quote unquote my mall is. And I was able to give her association and encourage her to pursue Krishna consciousness, because there's no temple anywhere near her. And then to recover from the mall, I went to India. So I'm always arriving there just before the GBC meetings. There's always so much going on. This year they organized, I don't know how much you've heard about the ISKCON Leadership Sangha, but this was organized for the first time. We're going to do it again in 2 years because it was so successful. And it was very encouraging because basically the GBC has been having their meetings and the strategic planning ideas have been implemented in their meetings for several years now, in which they identify what are the important issues that they need to really look at in depth. And then they've made committees, and then they have been dealing with those issues in committees. But this has all kind of been kept in the GBC arena. And the ISKCON Leadership Sangha was to take all of those initiatives, I call them, and give classes to the leaders of all the temples all over ISKCON. So they invited not only the temple managers, but other people in each community who were invited to come to these meetings. And, I mean, it wasn't really meetings, it was actually seminars. So different devotees gave classes, and it was arranged so that if you couldn't catch a seminar at one particular time, the seminar was repeated again another time, sometimes 3 times, sometimes even 4 times. So everybody got to participate and hear everything they wanted to hear. So Mukhya Prabhu was there, and Ramiya and Ananta, and they invited me to come to the meetings, even though I didn't know that I was invited, but I did go to some of them, and they were very, very interesting. I especially appreciated one about establishing Srila Prabhupada as the founder of Acharya Viscount. Like, what does that really mean? And they still haven't completely finished it. Govinda Swarup is apparently very meticulously into the details and so on, just to get it, to get everything exactly right. So someday you'll hear the final result of that. But I went to like three different devotees gave classes about what it means that Srila Prabhupada is the founder of Acharya Viscount. So just to continue on, the other amazing, wonderful thing that happened in Mayapur this year was the first Kirtan Mela, 4 days of chanting 12 hours a day. So with experience, 12-hour kirtans, perhaps 24-hour kirtans, but this was the first time, like about 1,500 devotees chanted 4 days, consecutive 4 days, 12 hours a day. And it was so wonderful. they're going to do it again. I think it's going to be a permanent part of the Mayapur Festival. I think, as far as I understand, they're increasing it to at least 6 days, which is pretty intense. But at the same time, I hope if my encourage devotees from America to make that trip to India during the Gokarni Festival, because it wasn't like anything I'd ever experienced before, and it, to me, this is what I would express it. I felt that the planets were moving, that the impact was so all-pervasive that it certainly, I felt, impacted all of ISKCON and all the devotees who were there, which is, it was like, normally at a Gokarni Festival, everybody's speaking different languages, and you don't really get to connect with everyone. But this brought everyone together. It was like one voice was chanting, and Satyananda Maharaj, who was like the main coordinator, he was, when we, if anybody was here, and probably most of you were here last September when he came here, and he was encouraging us to chant from the heart and just, you know, have that depth of chanting. And I felt that in this kirtan, just whenever I was there, and even when I couldn't, when I was in my home in Mayapur and I was cooking lunch, we would turn around on Mayapur TV and keep the kirtan going. And I'm sure some of you, if not most of you, heard about the kirtan and listened on Mayapur TV, and devotees have reported to me that they could feel what I'm describing, like this intensity. And to me, it was like, this is why I joined the Hare Krishna movement, for this chanting. Like, it was like, why aren't we doing this more? I mean, we're doing it so much. I'm not saying that, I'm not trying to criticize it's already happened, but it was just an experience of like days in a row, like this is what we're doing all day. We're chanting Hare Krishna, and we're, you know, coming together to glorify the Lord, to it was just our worship. It was very, very wonderful. Anyway, that there's other things I can say about the Mayapur Festival, but I just want to say when I came back, I went to a wonderful program that Lakshmanani and Akuti organized, about the Women's Weekend Retreat, which was really wonderful, except that we all got bitten by chiggers, but it was a lesson that that you know, there's always some material aspect that, you know, like there's the good and the bad. But and then I went to the Festival of Inspiration in New Vrindavan, and this was a wonderful festival. It had many different seminars going on. I'm just going to share with you the one that I appreciated the most. It was given by Vaishasika Prabhu, who normally gives classes on book distribution, but this class was entitled How to Be a Happy Human. Sanskrit is a Sukhi Nara. And the one thing that that stuck with me that I really appreciate, somebody recently was talking in class, I guess it probably was Divyanga yesterday, saying how amazing this body is. I mean, it really, you know, is an amazing machine, right? So he was asking us, so if I ask you to cut off your thumb and give it to me, would you do it if I give you $10? And, you know, would any of you give me $10 for your thumb? No? Okay. $1,000? Would you take, you know, $500,000? No? Half a million? Okay, well, that would buy a pretty nice house at $500,000. So you're saying your thumb is worth at least that much more, right? And you've got 10 fingers and 10 toes. And you've got a liver and you've got lungs and you've got, you know, so many things. So you add it all up. I mean, it's you know, beyond calculating its value, right? So that example just hit me as like a different view of valuing this body. body, and yet we know that this body is temporary, it doesn't belong to us, and so on. But it was a way to appreciate. I mean, his whole class was really about appreciation. In fact, when I came into the class, I was a little late because I was helping in the registration cabin. And when I got there, there was a rip-roaring kirtan going on. And I was thinking, he must have said at the beginning of class that the way to be happy is to chant Hare Krishna. And therefore, we had a kirtan. But then later, when I found out, he actually hadn't said anything at the beginning of class. But yet, I got the point that really, if we just are chanting Hare Krishna, there's no room for being unhappy. And it's described in the beginning of the songbook, the Prabhupada said, that it's the safest position in the material world. So again, it comes back to what Prabhupada is saying in this purport, how Krishna is our only shelter. And I want to end class on this note. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments?
Kirtan in Mayapur. How many days was it?
4 days this year.
4 days. I was reading the day before yesterday on the Sri Bhaktisiddhanta by Baba, in the first volume on the chapter entitled Festivals, when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta introduced the Mayapur festival for the first time. And he said that all his devotees from all the 64 temples, unless they had something that they could not absolutely give up for the time, they should all come to Mayapur. And he introduced 3 days of kirtan they had to festival. And also on the topic that you mentioned, the devotees used to take sannyas at an early age. There was a discussion on Bumbo maybe a couple of years ago about this. And Malati Prabhu, she was saying that now we give sannyasi to old people. And many of them are ill, they cannot travel, except of course Jack Patakaswami is on a different level. But it's better that they take sannyasi at an early age and give at least 20, 30 years of active preaching. And even if they fall down, what's the loss? That was their point.
Well, that's an interesting point in it, but in some ways that's like it's like undermining the sannyas ashram, the concept itself. What I was going to add is that life has its stages, and we have to eventually come to the stage of renunciation, and it should be done gradually. And as the body gets older, the senses gets, less active, and so it's possible. So we should look forward for that. I mean, Maharaj Shoda was, she was already realizing that everything belongs to Krishna. Of course, we know that too. But when you're in the Vyasa Ashram, especially, you need these facilities to go through Vyasa life. But as one gets older, the kids get bigger, responsible, then the parents still, they can rather renounce. I think that's important. And the other point we're talking about kirtan, sometimes we can get into small groups and perform kirtan. Three, four devotees get together and in the villages and wherever we can do that. That's very interesting. It's a good concept. We don't necessarily have to have one big work here done, but we can, and then sometimes we can come together and have a big one, but devotees can have little social gatherings.
I think that is going on. In our community, there are kirtan, different groups. It's true, it doesn't need to be any particular size. We can just do the chant alone. There's one point about the organization. I agree that as we get older, it's easier to announce. And just another point about the early days, people were able to take their kids to dance for cool, for instance, and leave them, and then do service, to go out and do Sanford time. But I've been told that when the school closed, it was a bunch of kids that the parents didn't even come to pick them up. Like, this is not a natural and normal phenomenon. I mean, the love you have for your child should be so... I mean, the love has to be there first in order to later be announced. I think that that's what was missing in the early days, was that the family unit is just not as strong as what we see in India. India, the values are there. The family unit is so strong. I mean, people will do anything for their family. They're just super tight. And in America, the family unit has just been, it's just been desecrated by, selfishness among people, or just different philosophies that have come up, like, be a rugged individualist and look out for number one, and all these, really nasty, when you think about it, they're really nasty philosophies. But we've been fed this message, in our childhood. And so therefore, I can see that when we were trying to raise families in the early days, and the devotees were told, okay, send your child away, or, your husband's going to take some ass, just accept that. It wasn't coming from the love was there, and then we're going to announce. I don't know. I'm not explaining it very clearly, maybe, but I hope you get the idea of what I'm saying. Okay, I'm going to take one from this side and then see if I come back.
Thank you for a very lovely class. I was also appreciating this point from your class in my mind when it comes to this language that we sometimes hear, that is quote unquote spiritual, but actually it's sort of almost pseudo-violent in terms of our psychological and emotional needs. And, sometimes when you hear it, it does more damage than good.
What do you think of the sympathy?
Well, sometimes when you hear, even in spiritual movements in general, violent language about renunciation, leave your families and leave you're not advanced if you're not renounced to some degree, but it's actually on a psychological and emotional level, it's violent, and it just doesn't do any good if you're not in a self-honest and natural position for renunciation. It just does more damage than good, I think.
Okay, I think that was one of the points I was trying to make, that it has to be real. And if it's real, then it wouldn't be violent. If it's completely sincere. And you can see by the number of people who could maintain sannyas that there was some potential in what they thought they could do. Another
question? Robert gave the definition of renunciation. You can go into the parables. Okay. Robert said renunciation is the result of genuine spiritual emotion. All other idea of renunciation should be checked by that list. There's a five types of false renunciation that we Vaishnavas should
renunciation is a genuine result of spiritual emotion. That's how I thought it was.